hate it as the way the policy world should actually do the assessment. Nonetheless, it took on a life of its own, and it's been used as a kind of a sledgehammer by the people who are arguing for aggressive methane control for one reason or another to try to put that onto the front of the agenda, when what really needs to be on the front of the agenda is just getting the carbon dioxide emissions to net zero. Methane's a sideshow in that regard.
Yes, and we're going to talk more about that in just a minute. Now, in a 2020 paper you co-authored with John Lynch and Miles Allen and Michelle Kane about a possible fix, it seems to me, called GWP Star. What is that?
Now, I said just before that the correct comparison between methane and CO2 is to equate a certain rate of emission of methane to a certain cumulative amount of CO2. And so GWP star is our factor that actually converts rate into tonnage. And it gives very different results for the importance of methane versus versus CO2, because it does take into account the fact that if you have a steady rate of emission of methane, that corresponds to just a steady temperature and doesn't cause the temperature to increase indefinitely.
I think people, including some scientists, are concerned even a short increase in methane emissions may stimulate other feedback loops or tipping points that aren't reversible. I mean, once we kickstart a forest die-off or burn it off or change an ocean current, it may not revert to its alternate state 20 years later when the methane has deteriorated. It may be thousands of years. Does that short-term impact worry you?
No, it's that's another fallacy, because the warming is still predominantly due to CO2, and so you're no more likely to trigger a tipping point by methane emissions than you are to trigger a tipping point by carbon dioxide, which is still the dominant influence on the climate. You're actually much more likely to trigger a tipping point by carbon dioxide, because what we know about a lot of these tipping points is that some of them take a long time to set in. They require warming to be high for a fairly extended period. So when you warm the climate by emitting carbon dioxide, then you reset the temperature to be higher for thousands of years. So that gives you a lot of time for that warming to trigger a tipping point. Whereas with methane, since you actually have the chance to dial it back down at some point in the future, you're much less likely to have as extended a period of warmth from that to trigger a tipping point. But we should get back at some point to just exactly what's wrong with this 80 times equivalent figure, because it does come down to the fact that a steady emission rate of methane doesn't cause a steady increase in warming. And we can talk through some examples of just exactly how that plays out.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
And you are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Oxford professor of physics and climate specialist Raymond Pierre Humbert. We are talking about the myths and realities of methane. So would you expand on that? What is the problem with the 80 times?
So it's become absolutely the go-to statement in among journalists in newspapers. You see this, you know, in The Guardian and all over the place. It's become the go-to statement in any article about methane to say that methane is 80 times worse than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. And sometimes they even leave out the qualification over a 20-year period. But even if you leave that qualification in, that 80 times figure is extremely misleading. And so what that leaves out is the fact that in the first 20 years, well, let's put some concrete numbers on it. The total world emission of methane by agriculture and fossil fuel leakage is estimated at something in round numbers like 300 million tons, 300 megatons per year of methane. And so in this 80 times equivalent, based on the GWP20, that would be equivalent to 24,000 megatons per year of carbon dioxide. Now, if you actually look at what happens if you emit that amount of carbon dioxide steadily versus if you emit that amount of methane steadily, what you find is that the two curves track. The amount of warming you get for the methane versus the CO2 based on that 80 times number. Those two curves track for the first 15 years, roughly. So in that sense, for the first 15 years, the equivalence looks pretty good. But in that first 15 years, only a rather small amount of warming actually happens, you know, something like 2/10 of a degree. And so past that time, past that first 15 years or so, the warming due to methane stops increasing. It's essentially flat, and it will stay essentially flat out to, you know, 1,000 or more years. But the warming due to the carbon dioxide, which is the supposedly equivalent emissions, past that 15 years, the warming due to the carbon dioxide keeps growing. By the end of 100 years, you've warmed the climate by about a degree. By the end of 200 years, you've warmed the climate by 2 degrees, just from that equivalent of the methane, the equivalent emission of CO2 to the methane emission based on GWP20. So the reason the 80 times over 20 years is a misleading figure is that, yes, that's true, but that only applies to the first 15 or 20 years. And after that, the methane warming stops. But the world doesn't come to an end after 15 or 20 years. The climate keeps on changing. The importance of methane versus CO2 is exaggerated by looking at the GWP20 equivalent. Because ultimately, the CO2 will always cause much more warming than the GWP equivalent emission of methane.
I get it. But when we add up all the energy and emissions from fracking in Texas to shipping and then methane burned in a UK electric power plant, do you think LNG is worse than just burning British coal in the first place?
LNG is way better than burning British coal, for sure. The only estimates that have ever been made that natural gas is worse than burning coal are based on, well, there are a number of flaws in some of the estimates, but the biggest flaw is using GWP20 equivalents. Because depending on what the estimates of methane leakage are from various fossil fuel productions, you know, maybe the statement worse than coal might be true if you were to think of just burning coal for 15 years and burning natural gas for 15 years, and then you stop both of them. But that's not how the energy systems work. We're talking about a steady supply of energy extending way beyond 15 years. And in that case, GWP20 greatly overestimates the warming that would be due to the methane leakage. And so between all the factors, it is a definite benefit to climate to switch from coal to natural gas. Part of that is that natural gas power plants are much more efficient at turning fossil fuel into energy than coal-fired power plants. And in addition, because of the chemical composition of methane, each kilogram of CO2 produced corresponds to a larger energy output than is the case for coal. So natural gas is doubly more efficient. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that methane, natural gas, is still a fossil fuel. And so you can get your emissions down by, say, half by switching from coal to natural gas, which is more or less what happened in the early days in the UK. But you can't get it down further. And if your energy usage continues to grow, before long, your methane CO2 will continue to grow with them. So that's why methane can have a limited use as a transitional fuel. But we need to stop using natural gas entirely in order to halt global warming. But it's not primarily because of the leakage. It's just because methane is still a fossil fuel and it still releases CO2. What we need to go to is heating homes, say in Britain or anywhere. What we need to go to is heating homes with heat pumps powered by renewable energy rather than heating homes by burning anything at all, whether it's methane or oil or whatever.
In a December 2023 article in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, you wrote, part of it is people don't realize how much warming we're in for due to carbon dioxide if we continue emitting the way we've been doing, and said methane is a drop in the bucket compared to that. Really?
Well, so yes, if you, as I said, even if you could eliminate all of the warming due to emissions of methane from fossil fuel production leakage and from agriculture, and that would be a really big ask, especially for agriculture, The amount of warming you would shave off might be something like a quarter of a degree. And that's nothing to sneeze at, but also that's if you really get rid of all the human-caused emissions. But it's something like a quarter degree. And that might look like a biggish number compared to, say, the 1.5 degree warming, which we're approaching pretty soon. But if we continue to emit carbon dioxide at anything like the rate we're doing now, we will blow way past 1.5. We'll go to 2 degrees. We'll go to 4 degrees of warming. And that amount of warming you could avoid by even very aggressive elimination of methane emissions, while it's nothing to sneeze at, it helps. It's still small potatoes compared to the amount of warming we're in for through continued emissions of CO2. And remember, again, if we develop technology to eliminate methane emissions 100 years from now, it still helps because the climate, that part of the climate damage will recover in 20 years or thereabouts. Whereas delaying action on carbon dioxide leads to an irreversible increase in the warming. So that's why these sort of sound bites you get based on how much warming from methane has happened so far, what proportion of the current warming is due to methane, they're not looking into where the big problems are coming in the future. And so that's why it's essential to do something to turn around CO2 emissions and get them heading towards zero as fast as we possibly can. You also have to take into account when people quote the amount of warming due to the methane increases in the atmosphere, that while we have good indications of how much methane has increased in the atmosphere over the past several hundred years, that doesn't tell us where that methane came from. Some of that methane is not actually a direct controllable result from human activities like agriculture or fossil fuel production. Some of that is actually a feedback that is caused by the warming of the planet, which then causes release of methane at accelerated rates from wetlands and perhaps permafrost and things like that. The part of the methane emission, the part of the methane increase that has been due to feedbacks like that, feedbacks on warming, that can only be controlled by halting warming. And the more warming we have, the more of those feedbacks we'll have. And ultimately, that warming will be increasingly dominated by carbon dioxide emissions.
And speaking of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, I believe you were part of the team that determined the doomsday clock should be set at 90 seconds to midnight. What is midnight? And is climate one of the reasons we hover in those last few seconds?
The doomsday clock was started in the wake of World War II and the atomic bomb development. It was started by atomic scientists involved in the Manhattan Project as a way of alerting the world to the risks of nuclear war. In later years, the climate risk was added to the kinds of existential risks, major risks to disruption of society that the doomsday clock measures. Since in the last two decades or so, we have factored in both the risk from climate disruption and the risk of nuclear war as primary factors in setting where the doomsday clock is set. We also track various other existential risks like biowarfare, cyber terrorism, and of course we are aware of the discussions surrounding artificial intelligence, but those other things are still rather hard to quantify, especially artificial intelligence risks and cyber terrorism risks. So it's fair to say that the main ingredients in setting the doomsday clock are climate disruption and nuclear warfare. And they have both gone into our decision that although we're not advancing the doomsday clock closer to midnight, we are still frighteningly close to midnight. And circumstances do not give us, unfortunately, any justification for pulling it back further from midnight.
Ray, you've been swimming upstream on this methane question for quite a while. Myth or not, it is a powerful fear for a lot of people. But we've used up a lot of your valuable time. What is your parting message for listeners who want real climate action?
Yes, so if you want real climate action, you should keep your eyes on carbon dioxide. Now, I don't want to leave people with the impression that controlling methane emissions is unimportant. If you can control methane emissions without having that detract from efforts to control CO2 and get to net zero CO2. That's a good thing. And so things like regulations that force fossil fuel companies to not leak so much methane into the atmosphere, those are generally good. Those are low to no cost things, and it's hard to see any reason that they would actually get in the way of reducing CO2 emissions. But if too much of the political capital and too much of the public attention is focused on methane rather than CO2, then there's the risk that the efforts will disproportionately go to methane. So my parting shot is, yes, it's good to find low-cost or no-cost ways of reducing methane emissions, but still, that's not the main issue. It's carbon dioxide emissions, and the main thing is to get carbon dioxide emissions to zero as soon as we possibly can.
From Oxford, we have been speaking with Halley Professor of Physics at the University of Oxford, Dr. Raymond Pierre Humbert. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Raymond, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you very much. Very nice talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org.
A U.S. government reports LNG export capacity for all North America, including Canada and Mexico, is likely to more than double through 2027. But that was before Joe Biden heard the polls showing voters, especially his supporters, want climate action. Millions of Americans have been slammed with long-lasting heat waves, storm after storm, fires, smoke, and the weirdest out-of-control weather they have ever seen. This climate issue is getting personal.
Give it to me straight. Is this it? The big checkout? Come on, level with me. How bad is it?
It's not bad. You'll be fine. You'll be back on your feet in no time.
Near the end of January, President Biden did announce a pause in the application for that large export terminal in Louisiana. That may stall another 7 new applications to build LNG ports, but there are still 5 already going in construction. Surely the government did an in-depth study of the climate implications before permitting this dash for gas? Not at all, as Robert Howarth told us. The 2016 law pushed by the gas industry lobby lifting the ban did not include any climate requirements. The law simply required the president and the Department of Energy to certify the export of gas is in the national interest, as was the case in earlier energy permitting law passed in 1938. That is all. As far as I can tell, Robert Howarth's new paper is the first full-cycle analysis of methane from the ground through liquefaction, shipping, regassing, and pipes to electric power plants. Howarth does not include emissions from the construction of all these new ports, tankers, and pipelines. You can find more on that in this 2022 paper by Kirsten Rosselot and colleagues, Greenhouse Gas Emissions from LNG Infrastructure Construction: Implications for Short-Term Climate Impacts. You can find a link to that in my blog at ecoshock.org. The law approving massive expansion of American LNG exports does not count climate impacts at all. What an amazing blind spot that needs to be fixed. President Biden's recent action at least acknowledges that a project that damages the climate and saddles Americans with climate-driven damages could not be in the national interest. The Department of Energy is now charged with looking into the climate impacts of this proposed Louisiana megaport. That is why it is on pause. I think the DOE is legendary for being energy-friendly and at times captured by the fossil fuel lobby. A long history of revolving doors between DOE and industry figures ensures great relations with the oil, gas, and coal producers, and so do big campaign donations. A previous study in July 2023 by Deborah Gordon, Drew Schindel, and their colleagues investigates methane leakage. The title of this open access paper is Evaluating Net Life Cycle Greenhouse Gas Emissions Intensities from Gas and Coal at Varying Methane Leakage Rates. Find a link in my blog. Quoting from that paper's abstract, "We find that global gas systems that leak over 4.7% of their methane, when considering a 20-year time frame, or 7.6% when considering a 100-year time frame, are on par with life cycle coal emissions from methane leaking in coal mines, end quote. Note those figures do not include carbon dioxide emissions when gas or coal are burned. Deborah Gordon and her colleagues continue, these numerous super-emitting gas systems being detected globally underscore the need to accelerate methane emissions reduction, accounting, and management practices to certify that gas assets are less emissions-intensive than coal. So we don't even know how gas compares to coal for sure when we add it all up. The methane gas binge is not limited to the United States. Two very large LNG export terminals are expected online on Canada's west coast in 2025 and 2027. They're shipping mainly fracked gas from Western Canada. Mexico has three LNG ports under construction, quote, Fast LNG Altamira offshore and onshore, and Fast LNG La Cache, both located on Mexico's east coast, and Energia Costa Azul, located on Mexico's west coast. And that's from the U.S. Energy Administration, November 2023. So this is not just to save Europe. The story to cover this massive move into more climate-wrecking fossil fuels and gas, North America is acting to save Europe after Russian gas supplies were cut off. But research into commercial contracts by three American nonprofit groups finds only 18% of contracts for LNG exports is for European buyers. Europe is installing alternative energy quickly and reducing gas dependence. No, the real demand for this fracked gas bonanza comes from Asia and from energy speculators. About half of these future gas contracts will be placings of major energy dealers looking to get the highest prices to win more profits and billions from this deadly game. The rest of us, including our descendants and all other species, lose. The groups called Earth, Public Citizen, and Bailout Watch just released their report, Methane Madness. You can find it at www.citizen.org or get a direct link for download in my blog at ecoshock.org. It's a free .pdf. It's short, it's direct, and well worth your time. Methane Madness. This report also claims building LNG export terminals will significantly raise prices for Americans trying to heat their homes and for American industry. Why? Quoting from Methane Madness, as the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, put it in a report, their internal quote, the expansion of LNG export capability has integrated formerly disparate North American regional natural gas markets into the global market, end FERC quote. What that means, in short, higher exports lead to higher prices. The main benchmark price for U.S. fossil gas, based on the Henry Hub Delivered Depot in Cushing, Oklahoma, has always been significantly cheaper than other global benchmarks used in Europe and Asia. But the more U.S.-produced LNG we export overseas, the more U.S. consumers become competitors in a high-priced global market. That's an end quote from Methane Madness. On the other hand, this Methane Madness report claims, quote, if built, the eight pending projects will produce the annual equivalent of 113 coal plants in planet-warming emissions. No, they won't. Our guest Raymond Pierre Humbert would object strongly. Leaking methane emissions from these LNG operations, from fracking to final destination, can never equal any coal plants. Escaping methane's warming impact will be half in 12 years and be very slight in 50 years. Burning coal releases large amounts of carbon dioxide that keeps heating the planet for thousands of years. You cannot compare the two. This exaggeration of methane leaks is all over the place. One investor newsletter tells readers, quote, if all projects currently in the permitting pipeline are approved, greenhouse gas emissions from the U.S.-approved LNG exports would be greater than 1,000 coal-fired power plants. Well, now it's 1,000 coal plants. There is no source for that, and it is not true. But set all those numbers and the controversy about methane aside, the true threat is carbon dioxide produced by burning fossil fuels, all of them, oil, gas, and coal. If the climate movement and governments put limited attention and money into cleaning up methane emissions, we really are doomed. It is the carbon dioxide, stupid. Fighting methane is a popular battle. For the past couple of decades, the Russians were content to promote fear of natural methane from the warming Arctic seabed, but not their own infamous leaky pipeline system of gas sales. During the early 2000s, methane was the only allowable climate action for that oil industry president and vice president Bush and Cheney. They approved collecting methane from landfills, but tried to stop NASA scientist James Hansen from speaking about climate change. Unfortunately, while a real risk, humans have a history of using methane fear as a distraction. The fight against the largest carbon maker, coal, is making progress in many countries, especially as renewables like solar and wind are cheaper to install and operate. But we hardly hear a whimper about the oil that drives the world and wrecks the planet. Who is campaigning to stop new oil drilling? Who is trying to block oil tankers? Who will apply tough sanctions against oil-producing countries? Nobody. That silence could cost us a future you want to live in. If we do not slash carbon dioxide emissions with emergency action, we will lose this green, nurturing planet to a hot, hostile landscape of extinction and extremes. Keep the focus. Stop putting carbon dioxide into the sky.
What do the Davos men and billionaires think is going to happen? Here is Bill Gates with Alistair Campbell on the Rest is Politics podcast, January 2024.
My last question relates to climate. You do hear a lot of young people sort of feel that the climate battle is kind of lost, that we're not on track, that the world is kind of burning and going to hell in a handcart. Now, you don't think that. You're more optimistic. So just give that pessimistic young person a reason to be hopeful, but also a reason to get active.
Well, there's a great book, the Hannah Ritchie Not the End of the World book, you know, which some people will find controversial. It's a very important corrective to remind people, A, we are making progress, and B, you know, that the world does not end at 2 degrees. Particularly,
we don't want to get there, though.
We will get there. There's no stopping us passing 2 degrees. In temperate zone countries, in terms of your overall economy or livelihoods, it's actually not a gigantic thing. Yes, you have to pay to make various changes. You have to have air conditioning more like the U.S. does, and in kind of this pervasive way. The really bad stuff is if you let it go, say, above 3 degrees, or if you live near the equator and you're dependent for your food on your yearly harvest, you have no savings. And so the fact that the weather is going to make things tougher, you know, that really is quite dramatic. And so take, for example, the UK, emissions per person are down very dramatically. You started the coal thing. Now you're by and large out of that. You know, the government made some commitments, which I think are great, you know, to try and have nuclear be a complement to the renewables, which makes it more feasible to get completely green. You know, so climate, there's incredible innovation going on, which I have a group, Breakthrough Energy, that funds a lot of that. And what I'm seeing makes me very hopeful that we'll, you know, stay not too far above 2 degrees, and that the right adaptations can mean the overall impact is not a super disastrous.
I'm Alex Smith. Your comments and tips and ideas are welcome. Email me at radio@ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
It's a number. It's the last thing